For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sale, and coming up in today's show, we're exploring the past through contemporary fiction. Hannah Kohler takes us back to 1960s America and the Vietnam War.
I was certainly interested in exploring what it would feel like for your entire life to be sort of swept up by a historical event.
Listener Chris Gray recommends a book about running away to join the circus.
A polar bear towered above it all, slashing blindly with skillet-sized paws. It made contact with a llama and knocked it flat. Boom!
And bringing us right up to date, we've got the first of Sarah J. Harris's podcasts about The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder. That's all coming up in today's show. But first, you may have heard the tragic news that author and chef Anthony Bourdain has died aged 61. His book, Kitchen Confidential, is one of producer Robert Kirkwood's favourite books, and he joins me now. Robert, what is it about Kitchen Confidential that you love so much?
I think the fact that it's such a gonzo book, you know, it's not really a book about cooking, although of course it is. It's not really a memoir, but it is. It's described as a deliciously funny, delectably shocking banquet of wild but true tales in the culinary trade from chef Anthony Bourdain. And he laid out more than a quarter century of drugs, sex and haute cuisine. And I actually have the insider edition in which the author has annotated. He's circled various phrases and updated them. And I just think it's a fantastic book, one that I return to again and again.
And because he was a chef who'd worked in some of the best restaurants in the world, it gives you that insight that makes you never quite so comfortable in a restaurant ever again.
There are parts of the book that when the book came out, he did this sort of tour talking about the highlights of the book. Although I enjoy the memoir part more, he says, don't eat fish on a Monday because the fish will have been delivered to the restaurant on the Friday. It'll have been there all weekend. It's been in fridges. And they won't get a new delivery until Tuesday. So discount sushi is a sign you should always avoid.
Yeah, there's a remarkable honesty there, both in terms of what he's prepared to talk about and in terms of not allowing the customer to be ripped off. I think in many ways it marked a sort of a move from consumers being seen just as punters to consumers actually being able to exercise their own rights and will.
Yes, and it also had advice for amateur cooks as well, saying what you should and shouldn't buy. It sounds as if it's a very bitty book. It's not. There is a thread running all the way through it. But let's have a listen. Here's Kitchen Confidential, narrated by Anthony Bourdain.
I'm not spilling my guts about everything I've seen, learned, and done in my long and checkered career as dishwasher, prep drone, fry cook, grillardin, saucier, sous chef, and chef, because I'm angry at the business, or because I want to horrify the dining public. I'd still like to be a chef, too, when this thing comes out, because this life is the only life I really know. If I need a favor at 4 o'clock in the morning, whether it's a quick loan, a shoulder to cry on, a sleeping pill, bail money, or just someone to pick me up in a car in a bad neighborhood in the driving rain, I'm definitely not calling up a fellow writer. I'm calling my sous chef, or a former sous chef, or my saucier, someone I work with or have worked with over the last 20-plus years. Now, I want to tell you about the dark recesses of the restaurant underbelly, because I find it all quite comfortable, like a nice warm bath. I can move around easily in this life. I speak the language. In the small, incestuous community of chefs and cooks in New York City, I know the people, and in my kitchen I know how to behave, as opposed to in real life where I'm on shakier ground. I want the professionals who read this to enjoy it for what it is, a straight look at a life many of us have lived and breathed for most of our days and nights to the exclusion of normal social interaction. Never having had a Friday or Saturday night off, always working holidays, being busiest when the rest of the world is just getting out of work, makes for a somewhat peculiar worldview, which I hope my fellow chefs and cooks will recognize. The restaurant lifers who read this may or may not like what I'm doing, but they'll know I'm not lying.
Anthony Bourdain reading his book Kitchen Confidential. It's available commercially in print and in audio now, as are his other books, Medium Raw, A Cook's Tour, and the fiction books Gone Bamboo and A Bone in the Throat. Anthony Bourdain, who's died at the age of 61. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hannah Kohler's debut novel, The Outside Lands, begins in San Francisco in 1963. America is mourning JFK, which seems to leave no room for Jeannie and her brother Kip to grieve their mother's passing. 19-year-old Jeannie hopes to find escape in marriage, while Kip, who's only 14, drifts first into petty crime and then to the Vietnam War. Neither finds happiness, and as their disillusion with the war grows, each will commit unforgivable acts of betrayal. The book is a compelling bestseller, and Hannah Kohler joined me in the studio to tell me more. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I think anybody who's read the book was rather surprised to find that you're English.
Yes.
Because the book reads like a great American novel.
Thank you.
Did you do an awful lot of research into your American voice?
Well, I live with an American, which definitely helps. But I did find that I needed to surround myself with American voices. So when I was writing the book, I read a lot of contemporary American fiction. I watched quite a lot of American television, including some pretty awful reality television, just to get a sort of sense of colloquial American voices. And after a while, it became easier to reach for the right word or the right intonation. But certainly at first, it was an act of will to think American.
And why write a book about Vietnam, which is a war that was over and done with before you were born?
I first became interested in the Vietnam War at school. I had a fantastic history A-level teacher who taught us about the post-war American period and had an amazing flair for anecdote and characterization. And the Vietnam War particularly fascinated me, I think, because of its scale and the poignancy of the draft and its relative historical proximity and the vividness with which it was represented in the media. It was the first television war. And that fascination didn't leave me. And later, I did a master's in American literature and I did my thesis on the literature of the Vietnam War, American literature of the Vietnam War. But of course, most of it is from the point of view of men in the theatre of combat. And I wanted to write a female domestic novel about the war, and domestic in the small and large sense, the home and the home front.
And actually, yes, I mean, the narratives are split pretty equally between the home front and the front line. Mm-hmm. I know that I read an interview with you where you said that being at home with small children felt like stopping being a career woman and becoming a 50s wife, which,
yes,
of course, is what Jeannie's expected to be. So
yes,
in some ways that helped your research, I should imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeannie is a sort of fairly repressed young woman, at least initially in 1960s America, and the expectations are that she will be a wife and a mother and experiences that sort of lonesomeness of and sort of boredom of suburbia and looking after young children. And I love being at home with my children, but there is definitely that aspect of parenting very small children, which is very closed off from the rest of the world. And I that absolutely fed into my portrayal of Jeannie, but also I think that sort of quiet really was quite fertile ground for imagining a story happening elsewhere.
Yes, certainly. I started writing when I was looking after my small children, just because it gave you that. Well, I think I needed to escape from the mundanities of filling the washing machine,
yes,
and pureeing food.
Yes, but, absolutely.
And Jeannie is also expected to take over a mothering role for the family as a whole after, mm-hmm, her mother dies. And you explore the territory of how much she needs to be her brother's keeper,
mm-hmm,
in the book. Was that something that came through strongly in your research for the period?
Well, you know, I think that perhaps came from somewhere else. I'm really interested in the sibling relationship and the limits of our responsibility to our siblings. And actually, I have a twin brother, and I wonder if that's... So that relationship has had such a primacy in my life. I wonder if that's part of why I wanted to explore it in the novel. But certainly, Jeannie is... She's young and she's struggling with the responsibilities that are laid at her feet by motherhood and by the death of her mother. And it's a responsibility that she instinctively wants to run from.
Her mom had always been superstitious about Kip's birthday. So when Jeannie was called into Mrs. Harris's office that November afternoon to take her dad's telephone call, it felt like a prank. It was dark out. Typing drill was nearly through. Jeannie stood at the ink-spoiled desk, looking out at the rain, the receiver tacky on her cheek.
Jeannie, you gotta come home.
Her dad's voice was swollen and strange. What's the matter, Daddy? A fly landed on the orange on Mrs. Harris's desk and picked at the rind.
Uncle Polly's on his way to get you.
Jeannie hadn't seen Uncle Polly since her dad kicked him out of their house for fooling around with his ceremonial sword.
What's going on?
Jeannie heard the warm sound of men talking. Who are you with?
I can't get into it, honey. Just come home.
Is everything all right?
Please, Jeannie. I'll explain.
Her dad's voice rose.
We're not done with our typing exercises, said Jeannie. Her face grew hot. I'm not coming till you tell me what's going on.
She watched the fly climb over the curve of the orange and wondered if they'd been disconnected.
There's been an accident.
Jeannie's heart flickered.
Is Kip all right?
A blow of breath down the line. The fly twitched.
He's all right, Jeannie.
Something in his emphasis made Jeannie wince.
It's your mother.
You chose to write her in the third person and to write the character of Kip in the first person, and you've said that you have a twin brother. Do you think that fed directly into your ability to be able to write from a male point of view?
I do wonder about that. I think perhaps yes. I think for me there wasn't much conscious strategy in choosing a third person voice for Jeannie and a first person voice for Kip. They sort of arrived in that manner, and the voice of Kip came to me quite vividly, and since then I'm writing something else which also has the voice of a young boy in it, and I do wonder if it's growing up so closely with a brother that has helped me in that endeavour.
And Kip, in many ways, is just as trapped by the expectations of what it is to be a boy in the late 1960s or early 1970s and what the army expects of him, and also by being the son of a soldier. So there's a lot of feeling of repression and being trapped in the book, not least because the national tragedy of JFK's death and Vietnam War overrides personal grief. Do you think that was a specific point in history that made that so difficult for the young people in late 1960s, or do you think it's being repeated today?
It's a really interesting question, and if you'd asked me this maybe 2 years ago, I would have given a different answer. I think I was certainly interested in exploring what it would feel like for your entire life to be sort of swept up by a historical event. And I think because I've perhaps been fortunate and we've lived through sort of a relative period of security and peace, certainly when I was growing up, it's not something that I had directly experienced. But I certainly feel now that the world feels increasingly unstable to me, and we're increasingly at the mercy of world events. So I feel quite differently about that now. It doesn't feel like such a sort of remote experience.
Did you try and draw lessons from history by reviewing a war that happened just before you were born? Or is that something that just came out in the writing of the book?
For me, when I was writing about this period, it wasn't so much about learning from the history as trying to understand what it was like to live that history. And the Vietnam War is is interesting because there have been so many portrayals of the war in film and television and in print that there's a huge amount of cliché associated with the war. So for me, the challenge was to try and navigate that cliché and try and get to some sort of portrayal of the war that didn't feel trite and rehearsed. So that was my primary preoccupation, which was to try and understand how it might have felt to live that history and to be in that moment.
And in your research, presumably, did you talk to veterans as well as read accounts of the experiences of people who fought in the war or fought on the home front?
Yes, I did. So I spent a day with a veteran of the war in California a few years ago. He was a Marine captain in the war. He was a career Marine. And he was extremely interesting because he completely bucked the stereotype of the haunted, regretful veteran. He was immensely proud of his service and regarded his services in Vietnam as some of the best days of his life. And that was quite a useful alternative view to many of the memoirs that I'd read, which were much more regretful in tone.
And I'm always fascinated with research. Where do you draw the line as an author between research and writing the novel?
This is definitely a tricky balance. I mean, I think I was at a bit of an advantage with The Outside Lands because a lot of the research I did was many years before I started to write the book. So I read a lot of memoir and fiction relating to the war in my early 20s and didn't start writing the novel until my early 30s, which was very useful because a lot of the research then went to the back of my brain. And I think that's half the challenge with research, is to not let it become in the foreground, to let it recede into the background and for your story to take primacy. I think in general, you know, I've had to learn that, you know, the story and the characters are everything. And, you know, you use the research, you use the facts where it can advance the story, where it can advance the character, but to be very careful not to sort of show your homework, because readers do feel that. And I think it's quite alienating if they feel you're sort of showing off your knowledge.
Yes, I suppose to drop in the odd reference to what cigarettes might be being smoked or what cornflakes are being eaten without labouring the point too much.
Exactly.
As I've said before, you achieve a very successful American voice. Has the book been well received in the United States?
It's been well received in the United States. I was so relieved, actually, when it got picked up for the States, and I didn't get sort of busted somehow for not being American or for getting it all wrong. So that was a really nice moment. It's such a sensitive period of American history that, you know, you sort of worry that it's going to cause offence that an outsider is writing about this period of history, which is still contentious in American life today. But no, I think it's been received well.
I believe that you're working on another book, again set in America.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, going back in time now. So I'm writing a book about two women in the California Gold Rush of 1849. And the Gold Rush really told people they could be somebody different. And for the women in my novel, it offers the opportunity to escape the constraints of their lives in Victorian-era America.
Again, ending up in San Francisco, which seems to be a city you feel great affection for.
That's right. The pull of San Francisco. Ultimately, it takes me all the way from Chicago to San Francisco in this novel, but I do end up in San Francisco. My husband's from San Francisco, and I've visited a lot, you know, particularly in sort of early days of our relationship and being in love. I don't know if that's got something to do with it, but it is a wonderful city, and it does draw the imagination.
Now, we at the RNIB have an enormous collection of talking books, and I'm very much hoping that The Outside Lands is going to appear in our library soon. Are audiobooks important to you, or are you a print reader?
I am a print reader, but audiobooks are important to me, actually. The reason that I'm writing the novel I'm writing now is that I heard a sort of extract of an audiobook by Steve Boggan on gold fever, on the gold rush, and I was undertaking a particularly menial task of driving to the pet store for cat food and really resenting it because I needed to get back to work, and heard this amazing book being serialised. That was the starting point for this sort of massive project that I'm now undertaking. So that it has, audiobooks do have a particular place in my heart, but also in my family. You know, young children absolutely love audiobooks, so I'm listening to lots of children's audiobooks in the car.
And you must be delighted with the high standard of the audiobook that's been made of The Outside Lands. I believe you've listened to it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm completely delighted, and particularly delighted with the voices that they chose, particularly the voice of Kip, who manages to sort of sound right between adulthood and boyhood, which is extraordinary for a sort of grown man actor. And I think he's done a brilliant job, Michael Crouch. And I was very pleased with the voices, and it was really thrilling to hear professional people read my words.
And to know that your book is reaching a whole new or whole different audience to the print books.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You mentioned that you studied American literature at university.
Yeah.
Who are your great influences as far as writing is concerned?
I think my greatest influence is probably Ford Madox Ford. So I read A Good Soldier when I was about 19, and it was my first experience of an unreliable narrator, a sort of self-conscious, unreliable narrator. And it made me realise that really all narrators are unreliable, and in fact we are all unreliable narrators. And that really changed the way I think about fiction and the way I think about life, really. And the unreliable narrator is just a very interesting figure for me, and it's something that really sort of fuels me when I'm writing a novel and trying to think about interesting characters.
Hannah Kohler, thank you so much for coming into the studio and talking about The Outside Lands and the next book, which, does it have a title yet?
Well, the title keeps changing. At the moment, it's A Good Woman Wanted.
I think that's a good title.
Good to hear.
And Hannah will be back at the end of the show with the books of her life.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come on this week's show, Sarah J. Harris explores what it's like to experience sound as colour, and Hannah Kohler shares the books of her life. But first, here at Read On, we love to hear what you're reading and how you access your books. You can email us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Contact producer Robert via Twitter @talking_books or ring the Connect Community Engagement Team on 0303 1234 555. One of our regular listeners who always has a good book on the go is Chris Gray. And today he's taking us into the world of the travelling circus. So roll up, and welcome back, Chris, to the greatest show on earth.
The book I'd like to recommend today is a book I read some time ago now, but it has stayed really fresh in my mind. It's called Water for Elephants by an author I've not read before called Sarah Groon. She's, I guess, an American author because the book is set in America. It's like someone who runs away from everyday life jumps on the train and finds that he has actually landed, run away onto a circus train.
The concession stand in the center of the tent had been flattened, and in its place was a roiling mass of spots and stripes, of haunches, heels, tails, and claws, all of it roaring, screeching, bellowing, or whinnying. A polar bear towered above it all, slashing blindly with skillet-sized paws. It made contact with a llama and knocked it flat. Boom!
The circus quite like him, actually, because they say, oh, well, you know, we don't go much on paper things around here. It's all kind of experience and so on, you know, which is a kind of valuable bit, the stuff of life and everything. So he kind of joins and becomes the circus vet, which, of course, gives him contact with quite a lot of animals, or with alligator, with the circus horses, with the elephant, who is, actually, the elephant is really, in my view, the star of the book.
Diamond Joe passed me at the human equivalent of a full gallop.
Jacob, it's the menagerie, he screamed. The animals are loose! Go, go, go!
Yeah, he talks quite a lot in the book about kind of circus history and circus life in the 30s. And it appears that circus life very, very kind of hierarchical, because you've got this circus train, like the owner or the master of the circus has his own carriage, his own stateroom, apartments and so on. And other people are like, you know, sort of packed like sardines into a carriage because they're just the guys kind of, it's like further down the food chain, I guess. Circuses too, it seems quite a sort of a brutal kind of place to be, really, because if you're not liked, you might just disappear.
Bobo is lying in the corner of his den with one arm stretched out over his head and the other resting on his chest. He sighs deeply, smacks his lips, and then rolls onto his side. So human.
There are a range of kind of views on elephants. The circus owner thinks the elephant is really sick animal and it can't get the elephant to do anything, and you know, he has a very kind of abusive relationship towards the elephant, and the elephant seemingly just seems to take it but won't actually do anything for this guy, whereas other people who the elephant quite likes, he will perform quite nicely for.
I have to admit, I wasn't so sure about you after yesterday. I'm glad you've come around. You won't be sorry, Jacob. It's the best thing for everyone. And especially you, he says, pointing at me with his snifter. He tips it back and drains it. I look after those who look after me. He smacks his lips, stares at me, and adds, I also look after those who don't.
It sounds like a novel that is full of great adventure and lots of thrills and spills. And it sounds rather funny in parts as well, Chris.
It is most definitely funny. You know, it sort of crosses that sort of gambit between the sort of tragedy and the harshness of life and, the kind of comedy in life too.
My eyes snap open. I struggle to rise. Didn't I tell you to lie still? Walter scolds. Marlena. Where's Marlena? I gasp, falling back on the pillow. My brain rolls in my head. I think it's been shaken loose. It's worse when my eyes are open, and so I close them again. With all visual stimulus removed, the blackness feels larger than my head, as though my cranial cavity has turned inside out.
William Roberts narrating Water for Elephants, written by Sarah Gruen, which is TB18575. Other parts are also narrated by Regina Regan.
It's also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB library. And don't forget that if you've got a book that you would like to recommend or review on the show, you can do so by emailing the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Chris Gray, thank you so much for a terrific recommendation.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Read On. Now, before we return to Hannah Kohler for the books of her life, Sarah J. Harris's new novel, The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder, is a cracker. It's a psychological thriller told from the point of view of a 13-year-old boy called Jasper, who has synesthesia, a condition that means he sees sounds as colours. He also suffers from face blindness and is quite possibly the only witness to his neighbour's murder. However, having seen the colour of her screams, he believes that he may well be the killer himself. It's a forensic study of what it's like to experience the world differently, and it's meticulously researched. In a series of podcasts, Sarah reveals the story behind The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder.
Hi, my name is Sarah J. Harris, and this is a podcast about my novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder. The story follows the world of a 13-year-old boy called Jasper Wishart. Jasper is not an ordinary boy. In fact, he would say he is extraordinary. This is because Jasper has two conditions that enormously influence the way he sees the world. One is synesthesia, a condition that comes in different forms, but in Jasper's life, it means that he sees the colour of all sounds, and every sound has its own unique shade. And the other is face blindness, also known as prosopagnosia, a condition that means Jasper cannot recognise people's faces, even familiar ones. Jasper paints the sounds of his world in a kaleidoscope of colours that no one else can see, until one Friday, he discovers a new colour, the colour of murder. In this three-part podcast series, I want to explore synesthesia and face blindness, meet some young people who have the conditions, and see how they can relate to my main character, Jasper. On this first episode, I want to explore the world of synesthesia. In my story, Jasper sees a world of colourful sounds. I wanted to meet someone who has a similar form of synesthesia to Jasper, so I met up with Sigourney Young. Just like Jasper in my novel, Sigourney uses her synesthesia to help her paint. I asked her to take me on an audio tour, as she shared with me just how she sees the world.
I have an experience that's very similar to Jasper. So I also have chromesthesia, so that's the association between sounds and colours. I experience mine most strongly when I listen to music or when I listen to sounds that are a little more persistent, but I hear it for all sounds. So footsteps or the tapping of pens or cars in the street. So all of those sounds that we experience in day-to-day life and the music that are part of our lives all have colours that I experience through associated synesthesia. So I see them in my mind's eye.
Well, we're walking around Covent Garden Market. Lots of people around. It's very busy. Can you describe some of the sounds that you're hearing right now?
Definitely. I can hear someone sweeping, and it's like a nice blue that has these cool textures and has a bit of lighter blue on the edges. So where he's pushing down, it's sort of a stronger, like, darker colour. And as he flicks it up at the end, it's like a lighter blue.
So it's quite a pleasurable sound to hear in terms
of
colour.
Yeah, it's nice.
Ahead of us there's a truck and there's some workmen loading rubbish onto the back of the truck, making noise. Can you describe the colours that you see for these sounds?
Yeah, when they're hitting, when what they're throwing into the truck hits the bass, it creates a black sound. It's very similar to drums, that short, kind of hollow sound. And as they yell to each other, it's a blue, but with a bit of an accent, so there's a bit of like a brown twang in there.
And we have a taxi ahead of us. Can you describe the sound of the taxi? It's just pulled up and the engine's running.
Yeah, the sound of the taxi is a kind of hollow, bubbly black and grey. And so it's very textured. It's definitely kind of bubbly or gravelly in the way that it looks as a sound. And then it has darker bits of black and lighter bits of grey and white, and a little bit of purple in, sort of to round out the colours.
We have a street performer in front of us, and he's making balloons, a balloon dog for the children, and he's talking to the crowd. Can you describe the colours of the clapping, actually, the applause?
Yeah, the clapping is lighter sounds. It's got oranges and yellows and kind of all sorts of different bright colours. His voice through the microphone is a darker blue.
So the microphone has an effect on the shade you see of the voice.
Yes, that's right.
When did you realise you had synesthesia?
Actually, not until I was in my mid-20s, because a joke fell very flat at a party. My friends and I were listening to a top 100 sort of playlist, and the top 10 songs, I made a comment that I thought was hilarious, obviously, that it was funny how all of the songs that were in the top were sort of this sunshiny, like, filtered colour, and in that year, filters were becoming really in, like photo filters.
Hmm.
And so I thought it was very fitting that all of the songs would match this new phenomenon in the world.
Yeah.
And, of course, no one knew what I was talking about except one friend who was a musician, and she said, I think you should look up synesthesia. And I thought I was just describing it wrong. I thought, how could people possibly hear sounds without the colours? That must not be true. Like, I'm just not articulating it correctly.
So you thought everybody saw the same as you?
I thought everybody saw it and that I just wasn't describing it right. And so I did a lot of Googling and spent about a month non-stop listening to every possible sound that I encountered. I remember going to the pool and swimming and listening to bubbles and the light blue. And they kind of have some yellow in them and all these great textures. And just thinking about the colour of bubbles for like 20 minutes straight and being like, okay, I think maybe I've taken this to its limit now. But I started painting so that I could show people what I was experiencing. I think that when you see a piece or those colours on their own, it can still be hard to translate it between a song or a sound back to the colours.
And can you describe some of the paintings that you've completed?
Sure, I paint abstract watercolours, and so people give me a commission or song request. It's often a wedding song or a first anniversary, because those are obviously things that mean a lot to people. And I listen to the song and I sketch all of the colours first and what comes out in different areas and things like that. And then I use my watercolours to create a piece that follows along with the song. And so you can look at the piece and see the introduction and see the piano and then see where the vocals come in and work all the way through the artwork. And I write a description of every piece as well, and that comes with the painting, and so people can read the description and follow exactly, so that they can kind of experience synesthesia as well, because I want people to have that.
That's wonderful.
Experience.
And do you have a particular favourite song or favourite piece of music for the colours that you experience?
It changes all the time, but just yesterday I was painting a fabulous song that was sort of 80s pop, and so it's full of synth and piano, and I was remembering how much I like those sorts of songs and colours, because they're these bold, airy, light blues that have a lot of buoyancy. I don't know what the right word is. They're just big and bubbly and airy, and so they have a great sound, and then they've got the sort of synth vibes in them, so they have bits of green, but everything merges together, because those beautiful 80s pop are such great flowing kind of songs, and so they're really fun to paint.
That'll make a beautiful painting.
Yeah, I've enjoyed that one.
So we're approaching a string quartet that's playing beautifully. Can you describe the colours that you see for the different instruments, or as a whole, the piece of music?
Definitely. The cello, I think, is always fun to start with, and that's a much deeper sound. And so that deep bass has more purple and dark blues. And then there's a violin that's been played very vigorously, and those are much higher notes. And so that violin has high oranges, but for most violins, the middle area is a magenta colour, and so the mid-tones are magenta, and then they go up to oranges when they're played more softly, like then that's kind of a light blue, and as they get lower, the blue gets darker. So those high notes are a yellow on the highest, and then an orange as he strums down, moving to a lower blue.
How amazing is that? Thank you so much to Sigourney for meeting me. We'll be catching up with her again in episode 3 when we'll hear how she relates to my book.
My name's James Wallison, and I'm the president of the UK Synesthesia Association.
After meeting with Sigourney, I talked to James Wonerton. I asked him more about the condition and its history.
Synesthesia is a neurological trait or a condition, and it results in the joining or merging of senses that aren't normally connected. And for example, someone with synesthesia may hear a colour, or they might see a taste. I mean, these experiences are automatic, and you can't turn them off and you can't turn them down either. As adults, our five main senses, sight, hearing, sight, touch, taste and smell, they're all processed by the brain independently of one another and in separate and different locations of the brain. But at birth, it's not like that. Our brains are a mass of neural connections, and everything's connected to everything else, and this includes the senses.
Can you explain some of the different types of synesthesia?
Taking all the known variables into account, I mean, you're looking at five senses, so you're talking at least 31 types just off those five senses. But in reality, the researchers have discovered and documented over 80 so far. I mean, these include the common types, such as grapheme colour synesthesia, that's associating letters or numbers with specific colours. We've got sound to colour, where the sound triggers visualisations of colour, and also generic shapes, which is quite nice. In my particular case, I've got a neural link that shouldn't really be there between the sound area of my brain and the part of my brain that processes taste. And for example, I mean, it does seem sometimes very random. I mean, for example, the word like. I actually quite like that because it tastes of yogurt, nice creamy yogurt. My dog barking, that actually tastes like I've got runny custard in my mouth. It's quite a weird one. The sound of the London Underground tube trains, the electric engines or whatever they are, that actually produces a very tart taste of rhubarb.
And does that affect your day-to-day life and the relationships that you might build with people?
When I look back at all my school friends, they all had names, or they've certainly all got names that taste nice. You know, that's more by design than accident, I think. And it carried on when I was a teenager. I mean, going out with girls, for example, it used to be part of the attraction. If they had a nice-tasting name, that was just as attractive to me as their personality.
And how did you cope at school? Were there advantages or disadvantages from your former synesthesia?
At school, it was sort of a double-edged sword, really. I had the fact that I got all these tastes and sounds, which caused distraction issues. I spent a lot of my time gazing out of the windows, especially in summer, because all the sounds of summer coming through the open windows was very nice for me. But I have to say this, at my particular school, we had the rote system of learning. Now, that involves just memorising big long lists of dates and locations, which I found very easy to do using my synesthesia. I could form a very, very quick link between a series of dates, and it's all automatic and requires very little effort. So it did help at school as well. It also played quite a large part in part of my language learning, because I remember we were actually given the option of learning either French or German. French lessons used to give me an overtaste, well, horrible overtaste of egg. It was not very nice. Whereas German, it was nice and nice, short, sharp bursts of marmalade. And so that sort of influenced my decision to take up learning German rather than French.
When did you find out that you actually had synesthesia? Was it while you were at school, or was it later in life that you were actually told this is what your experience was?
I can specifically date the first time because I used to travel on the London Underground system with my mother to preschool, and I was learning to read and write, and I used to read out the names of the stations as we passed through them. And they all came with a taste. And when I got home, I used to write those tastes down. As for finding out whether it was a real thing that other people had, I mean, that took me until I was age 20. I happened to notice a programme in the United States, it was. It was a woman going down some sort of boulevard with a big boombox thing on her shoulder with all funny colours coming out of it. So she was obviously experiencing something when she listened to music colours. And I thought, well, it's not the same as mine, but it sounds similar. Further investigation proved that people were actually investigating it, and it had a name, synesthesia.
Can you imagine a world without synesthesia for yourself?
My synesthesia is as natural and as normal to me as breathing, so I couldn't imagine not having it. I wouldn't know how to remember. Well, I wouldn't have any memory cues to pick up on for a start. I couldn't imagine how I'd try and remember stuff. For me, it's a fundamental part of who I am. It's the way I've always looked at people. It's the way I've always looked at people and objects. And I couldn't imagine a life without it. I've met maybe one or two that have had issues with it, and this is mostly down to overloads. It's a bit like sensory overloads for synesthetes. Same sort of thing as autists have. It's where the world just seems like a whole series of flashing lights and loud noises and bangs, and everybody keeps poking at the same time. Sensory overloads, that's the only downside.
Thank you so much to James for talking to me all about synesthesia. My novel, The Colour of B. Larkham's Murder, is available in audiobook, hardback and ebook from all good retailers. In the next episode, I'll be looking into the condition of face blindness.
Thanks to Sarah J. Harris. The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. And remember to tune in next week when Sarah will be investigating face blindness.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long. One side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, blah, blah. How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bockingtook?
Bockingtook, yeah. It's Bockingtook. A new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake, and if
Damn. Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to Hannah Kohler for the books of her life. So, Hannah,
Was there a book that you read as a child or a young person that made you want to become a writer?
I think this book will be common to lots of other readers and writers as an important childhood book, Matilda by Roald Dahl. As a fairly shy, inward, bookwormish sort of little girl, reading a book where the heroine was a reader and the power and magic of being a reader and having imagination was wonderful. And it made being a reader something to be proud of and something that could be legitimately part of your identity. And, you know, I've thought about that book a lot since.
It's a funny thing about mothers and fathers. Even when their own child is the most disgusting little blister you could ever imagine, they should still think that he or she is wonderful. Some parents go further. They become so blinded by adoration, they manage to convince themselves their child has qualities of genius. Well, there is nothing very wrong with all this. It's the way of the world. It's only when the parents begin telling us about the brilliance of their own revolting offspring that we start shouting, "Ugh! Ugh! Bring us a basin! Ugh! We're going to be sick!" School teachers suffer a good deal from having to listen to this sort of twaddle from proud parents. But they usually get their own back when the time comes to write the end-of-term reports. If I were a teacher, I would cook up some real scorchers for the children of doting parents. "Your son, Maximilian," I would write, "is a total washout. I hope you have a family business you can push him into when he leaves school, because he sure as heck won't get a job anywhere else." Or if I were feeling lyrical that day, I might write, "It is a curious truth that grasshoppers have their hearing organs in the sides of their abdomen. Your daughter Vanessa, judging by what she's learnt this term, has no hearing organs at all."
Matilda by Roald Dahl is available in giant print, Braille, and as TB23481.
Is there a book that you'd like to curl up with on a rainy day and reread?
The book I'd like to curl up with is A Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford. It was a book that I came across at university, and it has a famous unreliable narrator. It's an immensely engaging book, and it completely changed the way I think about fiction and what it is to be a narrator and how perhaps all narrators are unreliable. And I haven't read it in quite a few years, so I'd like to curl up with it again.
This is the saddest story I have ever heard. We had known the Ashburnhams for 9 seasons of the town of Nauheim with an extreme intimacy, or rather with an acquaintanceship as loose and easy and yet as close as a good gloves with your hand. My wife and I knew Captain and Mrs. Ashburnham as well as it was possible to know anybody, and yet in another sense we knew nothing at all about them. This is, I believe, a state of things only possible with English people, of whom, till today, when I sit down to puzzle out what I know of this sad affair, I knew nothing whatever. 6 months ago, I had never been to England, and certainly I had never sounded the depths of an English heart. I had known the shallows. I don't mean to say that we were not acquainted with many English people. Living as we perforce lived in Europe, and being, as we perforce were, leisured Americans, which is as much as to say that we were un-American, we were thrown very much into the society of the nicer English. Paris, you see, was our home. Somewhere between Nice and Bordighera provided yearly winter quarters for us, and Nauheim always received us from July to September. You will gather from this statement that one of us had, as the saying is, a heart. And from the statement that my wife is dead, that she was the sufferer. Captain Ashburnham also had a heart, but whereas a yearly month or so at Nauheim tuned him up to exactly the right pitch for the rest of the 12th month, the 2 months or so were only just enough to keep poor Florence alive from year to year.
P. Peter Wickham narrating The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, which is TB16485. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the audience?
A book that I've read recently that I loved was Spoils by Brian Van Reet. It just came out. It's a book about the Iraq War in 2003. Van Reet was actually, he actually fought in the war, but this is fiction. And it's an extraordinary book. It's unusual in war fiction in that it's narrated partially from the point of view of a woman soldier in a tank regiment. It's very moving. And it's really, in the way it's told, really feels like a book that's a product of its war. A lot of the way it's narrated reminds you of TV reportage, perhaps even of video games. It's very fast-paced, very visual, very slick, and very different to a lot of the books that I've read about war. It's very compelling.
Jihad here is like jihad in Eritrea, Chechnya, or anywhere else. The battle is always the same. To restore peace in the war-torn, hope in the downtrodden, tenacity in the meek, and a zeal for life in the minds of those who have lost any sense of vitality. The war on the ground is, and always will be, secondary to the greater jihad, the more difficult inner struggle. In any honest assessment, I find I am losing. There is sadness, but also a certain liberation in acknowledging this, if only to myself. Years ago, shortly before we parted last, my wife asked me when my belief began to falter, and though I denied it ever had, the truth is I can't remember a time when I felt otherwise. I must have been a small child in my father's house when hesitation and doubt first gouged their worrisome orbits around the same few unanswerable questions that have persisted to torment me all my life. I should begin by admitting this. When I was much younger, at the close of every prayer, I asked for the strength to die unafraid. Now, more often, I pray to live righteously.
Spoils by Brian Van Reet is available in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Armando Duran. Don't forget you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.